You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Cashman. Thanks for listening in once again. The Tigers and Royals, it's their world. We're just living in it. The Tigers especially, just unstoppable offensively. And the Royals have taken some injury hits in the past week, but they're still strong. It looks like a great division race between those two. We thought this would be more of a four or maybe even five-team division race, but some early struggles from the Indians and White Sox, two clubs who had a lot of high hopes going into this year. So we'll talk to Jordan Bastian and Scott Merkin about those issues and talk to Rhett Bollinger about a Twins team that recovered nicely from a rough first week. So we're going to handle all things Central here. Thanks for tuning in. The Tigers could not be off to a better start, best start in baseball. Their lineup is just the juggernaut we expected and probably even better than expected in some areas of it. But back on the topic of better than expected, Shane Green, who I think you and I agreed was probably a nice, maybe even sneaky pickup for the Tigers over the winter. I think he's exceeded everybody's expectations three starts in, 0.39 ERA. He's thrown about 70% of his pitches for strikes. He's been efficient, quick innings, and he's just been mowing people down. What have been your thoughts on Green and just how nice that acquisition has been for this rotation?
You know, it's funny. In spring training, you know, he had his proponents and his detractors among, you know, scouts who'd come through. Some people thought that Dave Dombrowski had made a sneaky good trade, and other people wondered what they saw in him and whether he could, slide into a full-time rotation spot after, I guess, what amounted to a half season in the Yankees rotation. But after watching the last couple of starts, I had the scout tell me he thinks he's, that Shane Green might have better raw stuff than Rick Porcello, which was really saying something. What he seems to be doing is just, you know, he's pounding the strike zone, but he's also shown that he's got a wider repertoire than I think some people suspected. And he's keeping people off balance for that. I think the outing he had against the Pirates, the cutter was a pitch that really flummoxed those guys. And he really silenced that lineup. Although, granted, they had trouble scoring runs for a good part of that series, but he really he never gave them, you know, kind of clean contact or a chance to really square a ball up. And so, and it seems like him and Alex Avila have really, and James McCann, for that matter, have really kind of found the chemistry there as far as knowing how to mix pitches, and he's smarter, I think, than some people gave him credit for. He's talked about never trying to fall into a pattern with these guys, and he's got enough pitches where he can change things up and keep guys guessing.
Well, naturally, Dave Dombrowski's getting praised, and Brian Cashman's getting crushed in New York for trading away one of the very few homegrown starters who succeed at the major league level from the Yankees' perspective. But looks like a good one for the Tigers, and especially important given what's going on with Anibal Sanchez. He had his struggles on the mound, and Justin Verlander, whose rehab plan has been slowed down here again by just continued soreness in that arm. How serious is it starting to sound with Verlander, Beck?
I think you have to start kind of accepting the idea that this could be a longer-term injury. And it's funny to think that about a month ago we were talking about this being a cramp that would not hinder him from making his final spring training start. He is not pitching the game since. It's lingered longer, and it sounds like it's gone from more of a cramp to a strain to lingering soreness to the point where you wonder if there's anything more going on here. I think you have to wonder just by the fact that it's lingered this long. And you know, I think we're past the point of, you know, simply being cautious. You know, They keep saying that if this was later in the season, pursue it. Well, you know, I can see that, but it also means that it's serious enough that they worry about him pitching through it and then making it serious enough where he might miss something longer. So, you know, I don't think it's anything to be taken lightly right now. And I think we're talking about more than just soreness. And it sounds like it's a more severe strain than people might have suspected.
Well, that's frustrating to hear. Obviously, you know, a lot of people rooting for Verlander to have a bounce back season, Certainly wish him the best physically. Anibal Sanchez is physically fine now, but statistically he struggled with the long ball. 5 home runs already this early in the year. That's a pretty jarring statistic. What do you make of Sanchez's struggles, Beck?
Well, it seems to continue a trend that was going on in spring training, although the Tigers don't really say that factors in because the spring training guys are working on certain pitches and they aren't really looking to sequence pitches in a way that would get specific hitters out. But that said, 7 home runs in 30 innings in spring training was out of sorts for him. And then when you tack on what he's done here the last couple starts, I think you have to wonder if it is kind of a trend and if he's just, in a little spurt where he's missing up and paying for it right now. It's something that it's unlike what he had, a couple of years ago, obviously, when he was led the American League in ERA, where he had a lot of pitches that looked the same coming out of the hand, and they would move differently at the last minute. But the most important thing is he was able to locate everything down. And it doesn't seem like he's got that going on right now, at least not consistently. So that's something where, you wonder if it's a mechanical tweak or something like that. If it is, I think you can count on Jeff Jones to take a look and them to try to work something out on that.
Well, there are issues like you mentioned with Sanchez and spring training that end up becoming real in the regular season, and then there are things that happen in spring training, and the season starts, and you wonder why were we even keeping score in those Grapefruit and Cactus League games. And I think Jose Iglesias would definitely fit that latter category, at 135. In Grapefruit League play, hitting .436 so far this season. And obviously, you don't expect Iglesias to be a major offensive force on this team. That's not where his bread is buttered. He's a defensive presence, and he's a big part of the reason why the Tigers' defense has been so much better this season. But as far as that offensive skill set, do you feel like there are real adjustments that have been made that could account for this strong start and could help him moving forward?
No, I think there were signs of encouragement, even in the struggling spring training numbers. The fact is there weren't a whole lot of strikeouts in those outs that he was getting in spring training. I think it was only like 3 or 4 strikeouts for the whole camp, and he played quite a bit. And so I think what Brad Osmus and guys were saying was that if he can put the ball in play with his legs, he's giving himself a chance. And I think he's found better spots. Obviously, he's made a little bit more solid contact. But I think, too, that just the numbers have come back around. And batting average on balls put in play has kind of come back to what you would expect for a guy like that who can hit for a little bit more punch than you would suspect, but also has the legs to turn ground balls into infield singles.
Victor Martinez obviously tweaked his knee in Cleveland. The surgically repaired knee, missed a few games. Back in the lineup now, Beck, but because of the way it impacts his swing, it sounds like they might have to limit him against left-handers.
Yeah, you wonder about that. It's something that when you look at the way he's winced on a couple of the big swings and you kind of worry about it. That said, there's not really an obvious substitution idea. It's hard to replace a guy like him, especially against left-handed pitchers. But I think for the long-term health for him and trying to have him available for as many games as possible, I think they might just go ahead and try to give him a break every now and then.
Yeah, that's probably a smart thing to do. Got to keep that bat in the lineup. Obviously, the lineup runs very deep right now, and it's a big key to the Tigers getting off the start they're off to. Winning first 10 of their first 12. So I want to thank Jason Beck for joining us to talk about all that, talking about the week that was and the week that will be with the Kansas City Royals. Jeffrey, those fighting, frisky Royals, man, they got they got edge to them. Geez, 5 guys ejected Sunday on the heels of a really contentious weekend with the Oakland A's, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You got Yordano Ventura staring down Mike Trout earlier this season. He's got an edge to it, don't they?
Yeah, they really do. I think they probably just got kind of set up with all the hit batters that they've had. I think they got 14 now, and That's either first or second in the league, and it just kind of came to a boiling point, especially Friday night when Lowry went into Esquihard and Escobar suffered a bruised and sprained knee and hasn't played since. And, you know, you can't really say any of the plays were dirty, but the consequences are the Royals their body's dropping here. And, you know, they've got three guys on the DL, and Fonte might go on the DL again today. So it's just I think they just kind of got fed up with everything, and everything came to a boiling point yesterday.
Yeah. And, yeah, on that note about the injuries, you know, the Esky injuries, obviously it doesn't seem overly serious, like a DL-type situation, but the Infante one, the groin strain, that's a much bigger deal, pulled up lame on the bases on Sunday.
Yeah, as you know, I mean, those things take forever to heal, so I kind of think that's going to be a DL. We weren't absolutely positive they're going to reevaluate today, but you know, they get kind of thin up the middle with Esky, and he's still kind of a maybe for tonight. I talked to him after the game yesterday, and he kind of, you know, just shrugged his shoulders whether or not he was going to play today. So you lose him and now Infante for an extended period of time. You know, it's going to test their depth. Christian Colon will probably step in at second, and the rookie Orlando Calixte will probably play short. But there's a pretty big drop-off at either position when you lose your starters like that. So, yeah, it's going to be a test of their character.
Especially parlayed with the Alex Rios injury, which happened, I believe, mm-hmm. the last time we spoke. That was a big deal as well with the start.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as good as things are going for the Royals in the win column, you know, this stuff's starting to add up.
Right, and we didn't even mention Greg Holland, too, who's
right.
out for at least 2 weeks with a pectoral strain. So that kind of thins a pretty strong bullpen. They've got depth there, but now you might lose Herrera to a suspension, and we don't know about Ventura either. So it's going to be a new-looking clubhouse when I get there today, probably.
Yeah, the Holland thing, they're fairly well protecting the bullpen. We talked about it many times. They ensured they have that depth moving forward, and I guess it makes this return for Ryan Madsen all the more important for them. But yeah, what's your sense of the Holland thing and how long that could be or how major an issue that is?
I think probably later in the year they probably would not have DL'd him. They would just let him, you know, shut him down for 4 or 5 days and just let the thing calm down. But this early in the year, there's no reason to take a chance and have that thing linger. So, you know, they're just being precautious here and just shut him down so that he's good for the final 5 months of the year. You know, they do have some depth down there. Madsen will step into the seventh inning role. Herrera moves up to eighth. Wade Davis will close. You still got Jason Fraser throwing real well. And Franklin Morales is pitching well. And Chris Young Long, they just called up Johan Pino, who had a really good outing on Friday in long relief. So, yeah, they do have some depth there, but really they just can't afford to keep, you know, losing bodies here. They're winning games. They're 9-3, but they're paying the price.
Yeah, and this is probably the most depressing podcast for a 9-3 team in history, to the extent there are many podcasts about 9-3 teams. But another depth blow is Brian Flynn. That kind of gets overlooked because at the minor league level, but that's a guy who nearly made the club out of spring training, and he's out for quite a while with a lat injury, correct?
Yeah, it's not necessarily season ending, but pretty close to it, and as close as you're going to get to it. You're talking 3 to 5 months before he'd be able to come back actively. So that was kind of a blow. I mean, he'd probably be up here right now if he was healthy, because he, as you mentioned, I mean, he had a terrific spring, you know, was throwing in the mid-90s with good command, and it's a tough break for him and a tough break for the Royals because they could have used him right now.
On a positive note, the Paulo Orlando story is pretty great. 4 triples mm-hmm. early on. It's like that's all he knows how to do is hit triples at the big league level. He's just a great story. Obviously, a guy who waited a long time for this opportunity at the big league level, and he's made a lot happen out there.
Yeah, he really has. I mean, you're talking 9 years in the minors, and didn't really grow up playing baseball in Brazil. It's not a big sport over there, and just a terrific guy, terrific story. And, you know, we're going to see a lot of them while we wait for Rios to get back, because he can play right field a little bit better than Dyson can. And not quite as strong as arm as Dyson, but he's got better reads. He's played right field a lot more than Dyson has. So we're probably going to see a lot more of him, especially if Escobar doesn't come back tonight, Ned kind of likes him in the leadoff spot. He's got some speed. And, you know, he is a triples machine right now. So they're going to have to lean on him and hope the league doesn't figure him out too quickly.
Hey, what was it like for these guys, for the fans, to have Billy Butler back and wearing the gold and green as opposed to the royal blue? Obviously, a guy who spent so long in the Kansas City organization and meant so much in the community, that had to be emotional on some level for everybody involved.
Yeah, it was. I think it was a nice story for about 5 minutes, and then all heck broke loose with Brett Lowry, and he kind of, that story just kind of got pushed to the side after he got his championship ring on Friday, and it was emotional. He was able to come back, and I think he wanted to visit with all his friends, and he's very close with Greg Holland. You know, Greg Holland's not feeling in the greatest of moods right now, so I don't know if they even hung out on Saturday, but it was good to see him back, and he got a nice reception from the crowd, and it was a feel-good story for a very short time, and then the hostility started. So it would have been interesting to see. You know, I mean, the benches cleared twice, and there was a lot of barking and jawing on Sunday. They didn't clear the benches, but what would have happened if there had been an actual fight? Would Billy have been in the middle of it, hitting his old friends, or somebody would take a shot at him? That was the thing we were talking about in the press box the most. And, you know, what would Billy have done? You know, would he have just kind of hid in the background or what? I mean, it's been really strange to see him in the middle of a fight with the guys he's played with for the last 8-9 years.
Yeah. Well, yeah, a lot of strange sights with the Royals here early on. A lot of friskiness, as we said. That's part of their profile now. But we'll see what that all means going forward with the bodies they've lost and potential legalities there. So. We'll see how it all plays out. I want to thank Jeffrey Flanagan for joining us, joined by Jordan Bastian, who's just back from a rough weekend for the Tribe in Minnesota, a rough start overall for the Indians. And JB, the main thing is they're just not hitting. Barely over 3 runs per game so far. I know nobody's counting on this to be a juggernaut offense, but certainly expect better than that.
Yeah, it's been a little disappointing out of the gates. I mean, obviously, losing Yan Gomes, removes a pretty potent right-handed bat from the middle of the lineup. You know, Michael Brantley has missed time, and, you know, who knows how much that back thing is affecting his swing right now. He's been getting a couple hits here and there, but, I think maybe it'll be a little while before we see the same kind of pop that he showed last season. And just up and down the lineup, Michael Bourne's not really getting on. Kipnis has been slow going. I think they're leaders in average. Levers, Santana, and Chisenhall, and they're hitting around 240. So, I mean, it's been a slow start. They're averaging a little over 3 runs a game, and that, in turn, is really magnifying any mistake that the pitching staff makes. I mean, there's little to no margin for error for the bullpen, for the starting pitchers. And granted, you know, a guy like T.J. Havis, who pitched the final game in Minnesota, he's had his struggles out of the gates, but other than that, I'd say that there's just this immense amount of pressure on the pitching staff right now due to the offense, and it's just been a bad combination out of the gate.
That's ironic, all that worry about Gomes, and not that this is going to sustain or anything, but Roberto Perez has been one of their better hitters so far, a couple home runs early on. And, yeah, they just really need to get the top of the lineup going. You don't harp on any one guy in a situation like this where it's up and down the lineup, as you said, but Kipnis, obviously, coming off the year he had, you certainly wonder about a slow start getting a hit in his head the way last season played out.
Yeah, I mean, a couple things. I mean, with Kipnis, I think we've seen, even for outs, some hard hit balls the other way, so you can go, okay, that's encouraging. You know, Brandon Moss has been off to a slow start, but in the Minnesota series, we saw him hit a home run to the opposite field. We saw him really pull a ball with authority for a double to right center. You know, so you're going, okay, you're starting to see his swing come around maybe a little bit. The guy that really is concerning to me, and granted it's 11 games, but Michael Bourne at the top, you know, we've talked about it before. Just remove the stolen base issues aside from the last few years. He just hasn't been getting on base since he's put on a Cleveland uniform, and they need him to, especially if Terry Francona is going to keep running him out as the leadoff hitter. So, you know, obviously you're not going to jump to, you know, any big conclusions or start calling for drastic lineup makeovers this early in the season. But, you know, you kind of hope with a guy like that to see some of those troubles of the past kind of get righted, and you know, so far we're not seeing that.
Absolutely. Well, on the topic of righting troubles from the past, Danny Salazar, on a positive note, came up, rejoined the rotation on Saturday in Minnesota and pitched pretty well. Two runs on six hits over six innings, a couple of walks, 10 strikeouts, and that strikeout-to-walk ratio is something you like to see from him. But it's kind of like you throw out everything you saw in spring training. He was a different guy in that one start. And it's only one start, but it was encouraging for sure.
Yeah, and I think the thing that really stood out was even talking to him the day before he started, he mentioned on his own that in spring training he felt like maybe he was focusing too much on everything but pitching. And they had harped so much on him, on his conditioning and getting his body in shape and trying to get that arm to where he could have the velocity that he usually would get about midseason. You know, he went out to Arizona early, really worked hard on that aspect of his game. And then when the games came around, his command was all over the place. You know, so I think he kind of admitted, hey, maybe I got too caught up in those other aspects and for kind of put to the wayside the actual pitching. And when we mentioned that to Mickey Calla, the pitching coach, you know, he was pretty encouraged that Danny kind of brought that up on his own, you know, because they had kind of seen the same thing. And, you know, I thought, you know, velocity-wise, he looked like mid-season Salazar in that start against the Twins. His split change was just dynamic. You know, he's dropping 10 miles an hour below his fastball, you know, in this pitch as the bottom keeps falling out. And then in the sixth inning, he actually flipped a curveball to Danny Santana, you know, and kind of raised some eyebrows. And when we asked him about that, he got a big grin. You know, he said something he's been working on the side. You know, it's kind of just a show-me pitch. But, I mean, when he's performing that well and all of a sudden he's got another thing to put in a hitter's head, you know, he can be pretty scary.
Yeah, I mean, we know he's got nasty stuff. That's why we're always so focused on him. And sometimes to his detriment, his struggles sometimes get a little more attention. And, you know, certainly like to see him rebound from a rough spring, and especially with the way things are going for the back end of the rotation. T.J. House's struggles, Zach McAllister is now back in the bullpen where they probably would have preferred him to be all along. But House's struggles, you know, this guy was very steady for them last season. Obviously, he's not going to overpower anybody, but brought them that steady left-handed presence in the rotation, and this season could not be off to a worse start for him.
Yeah, and I think one thing that's important to point out with him is the really odd schedule he's had. You know, these guys are so used to working on every five-day routine. This guy had 19 days off between his last spring start and his first two starts of the season. You know, so he's been working kind of that life of that fifth rotation guy where in order to keep as many of those guys on their regular routines, one guy's got to kind of be the sacrificial lamb, and that's been T.J. House early on. And, you know, not that you can put it completely on that, but we've seen a total lack of rhythm on the mound, and maybe part of that is the complete lack of rhythm in his routine, you know, behind the scenes. So, you know, we'll see. You know, maybe things will start getting a little more regular. And, you know, we saw last year when he was kind of a fixture in the rotation the second half, what he was able to do. You know, he had a sub-3 ERA in the second half. So they've seen it in the past from him, and that's kind of why they're hoping they can keep running him out there and he'll sort this out. But you're right. I mean, if that's your fifth guy and a guy you're going to be leaning on right now, you know, you need to get much, much better production than you've been getting to this point.
And another off day on Thursday, so possibility of him getting that same treatment this turn through the rotation and affecting his schedule again. And, you know, one reason the rotation is set up the way it is right now, Carlos Carrasco comes back within a week of that just horrendous line drive to the cheek off the bat of Melky Cabrera, comes back a week later. They move some things around at some point, but basically, you know, right on schedule, which is not something you would have expected in that moment when he's laying there on the ground. That was a rough moment.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, I when he came up and he was holding the opposite side of his face, I thought he fractured his jaw. Just because, I mean, you could tell it obviously jarred him, and I think it may have dislocated his jaw momentarily. He said he blacked out for 10 seconds before he started hearing the trainer talking to him. It was really scary, especially being there live, you know, and see that, you know, all of a sudden you forget about the baseball and you just worry about the person, you know, especially, you know, he just had a daughter and all this stuff. I mean, you don't know, you know, what could happen there. So I think it's pretty miraculous that he came back a as quick as he did, the fact that he's going to be able to make his next start within a week of that incident is pretty incredible. You know, and they dodged a pretty big bullet here. And, you know, really the only thing he's been dealing with is some soreness with that jaw, some difficulty eating, you know, and that's kind of why they wanted to give him just extra days before returning to that rotation.
It's the only worry, and it's just because this is a guy in the past who has had some issues sometimes controlling his emotions on the mound and that sort of thing. But you do wonder about the psyche after something like that. And other guys have had to deal with this as well. Alex Cobbs and Brandon McCarthy's of the world have to get over that mental hurdle of getting back out there when really your worst nightmare as a pitcher came true of getting struck by a line drive like that. So that's I guess, the last hurdle has to be crossed.
Yeah, for sure. And I think just from talking to him and from knowing him and seeing his kind of improvement maturity-wise and mentality-wise over the last few seasons, you know, I'm not really too concerned about that. You know, he doesn't seem to be as mentally fragile as we kind of thought he was a few years ago when he had those issues with the suspensions and you know, just his struggles on the mound. You know, this is a guy that we've kind of seen grow up behind the scenes over the last 2 years. So, you know, I don't really worry too much about that, but you're right. You never know. I mean, he's going to be facing the White Sox again. He's going to be facing Melky Cabrera again, you know, and, you know, you'll be looking for that first, even if it's a weak comebacker to the mound, just kind of how he responds. And it'll be interesting to watch. And hopefully for the Indians, there's no issues there at all.
Should the Indians be worried that Corey Kluber does not know how to win?
Yeah, he's just not a winner. You know, this is going to cost him when the Cy Young voting comes around. Some guys just know how to win. Make a pitch, win a game, let's go. Nah, he's been pitching great. You know, it's pretty much a shame. It's like every element has hurt him. You know, the first game, he had no offense. The second game, he left in line for a win, and the bullpen coughed up 7 runs late. And then the third game, there was no offense, and the defense had issues behind it. So, you know, I mean, kudos for him. He's doing his job. He looks as sharp as he did at any point last year. And he's just running into some really tough luck out of the gates here.
Yeah, just got to ride it out. It kind of reminds me of Jeff Samardzija a year ago. He's kind of off to that kind of a start where just getting no help on any front. And you'll have those guys every season. Some guys get all the help in the world, and it inflates their performance, and some guys get deflated. So we'll see.
Yeah, I mean,
the Indians obviously have go ahead, JB.
I was going to say, just, you know, in terms of the wins thing, you could also point to the Carrasco start. He took the loss. He faced two batters, left with a bruised jaw, carted off the field, and the Indians didn't score, so he gets the loss. I mean, that just shows you the value of that stat category.
And I almost feel like now anytime we reference Carlos Carrasco's ERA going forward, we almost have to go back and mentally take out those two runs and that, you know, just take out that performance entirely. So, got some legwork on our part. But you know what? I take that over getting hit in the face by a line drive.
yeah, no kidding.
A little more taxing. So, all right, I want to thank Jordan Bastian for joining us. Pleased to be joined by Mr. Scott Merkin, who, Merk, you're off to a better start than the White Sox, I would say. Your writing has been sound, technically sound, polished.
Excellent.
White Sox are struggling a bit.
You even got the new Facebook page up and going. You know, we're going even a little extra.
Yeah. You're a multimedia superstar, as we established in spring training. That's been good to see. So the White Sox, on the other hand, you know, in the midst of a slow start, already called up Carlos Rodon. I mean, I wouldn't have guessed he'd be up this soon. Maybe you're less surprised than I am. What's your take on him coming up and joining the bullpen here in April?
No, I wasn't as surprised as you are, Anthony. We had talked about it during our there were 3 day games in Detroit over the weekend, which is kind of rare, so a lot of time to sit and talk in the press box. And we kind of guessed that just looking at the land of things, you know, probably like they play in Minnesota the last series in April, which leads into the beginning of May, and we figured maybe that one or maybe, you know, the homestand after that where he'd be part of the rotation. And again, that's not taking anything away from John Danks or Hector Noesi, because Chris Sale, Jeff Samardzija, and Jose Quintana, barring an unexpected injury, are pretty much locked in. But Don is a difference maker. He's kind of a game changer, to throw all the cliches out there. But it's interesting that he came up now as, you know, bullpen. Now, Robin talked Friday and was pretty demonstrative about, you know, because Friday was Chris Bryant Day, of course, in Chicago, and was pretty demonstrative that just because one top prospect came up, they're not going to bring, you know, theirs up. And there had to be a need. Well, there appears to be a need with Javi Garrett going on the disabled list, you know, retroactive to April 13th. So we'll start in the bullpen, and it could be a stint in the bullpen about as long as until Javi Garrett gets healthy and comes back from the disabled list.
And it could end up being a spot in the rotation, as we know, as you alluded to. I mean that's where Rodon's future is. And there have been some struggles in the back end rotation, Danks in particular. What have you seen from Danks here early on? I know he thinks it's not as bad as the over 6 ERA would indicate, but what have you seen from him?
Yeah, you know, in general, the rotation has not had a great start. They had 4 quality starts in their first 11 games, and as strong as the bullpen has been overall, that's going to be, you know, the group that kind of drives them is the starting rotation. And, you know, Danks is a different pitcher. We've said this a bunch of times, and he's probably tired of being interviewed about it or tired of hearing it, but he's a different pitcher than the guy before the arthroscopic surgery in, I believe it was 2012. And, you know, I think even a couple years removed now, he's still trying to find that groove. You know, he's working with a new arm slot, a little lower. He's working with a different leg kick in the delivery. Just trying to, you know, keep the ball in the ballpark. That's been his biggest foible over the last couple of years is too many home runs. And
right.
He's still a solid pitcher. He had runs last year. He had, you know, 6 or 7 start runs where his ERA was around 2. So he can get it done. It's not like he's, you know, can't do anything. But, you know, he's just a different guy. And I think, you know, people talk about him in comparison to like a Burley sound. His delivery actually even looks a little like Mark Burley right now. And I think, you know, that's what they're looking for. Obviously, Mark Burley's had a great career, just won his 200th game. But I think, you know, if they can get – they're looking at John as more a 30-start, 200-inning guy and get the best they can out of him. Now, that's not selling him short, but I think, you know, they just don't envision him as a top one or two guy in the rotation at this point.
Right. And with Rodon, I mean, do they – as you said, this could be a short-term bullpen situation. That seems best for Rodon to not be a long-term bullpen option for them, just because he's got to develop as a starter. That's his future, no?
Well, yeah, it is his future. But remember, Chris Sale, who's now one of the best starters in Major League Baseball, served, what, a year and change as, you know, as a reliever and did pretty darn good job of it and transitioned pretty well. Now, you know, Carlos has never, much like Chris, has never done that really, and, you know, worked in relief consistently. So it'll be interesting to see if they do keep him there or if this is just kind of a short-term apprenticeship until they figure out some way to move him into the rotation. Ultimately, and long-term, for whatever length Chris or Carlos Rodon is here, whether it's 7 years, 15 years, he's a starting pitcher. There's no question about it. Now, could it be that he adds some sort of unbelievable intangible to that bullpen and maybe is a guy who can do a little what, you know, Brandon Finnegan did for the Royals last year in the playoffs, and, you know, a starter goes 5 innings, Carlos Rodon comes in and pitches the 6th and 7th and really kind of bridges the gap into the late-inning guys. Possible he could also, you know, be a late inning guy. But again, I don't, even this year in the bullpen, I don't see it being a long-term thing. And again, you know, Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams and Robin Ventura and Don Cooper will have more say on that, but just my opinion, I think he's going to be a starter sooner than later.
And it seems like that could be where their need arises. Jose Quintana's early struggles, we talk about Danks, he's not counted on to be a front of the rotation guy, but obviously Quintana is that kind of a guy for them. He's are their big three, so to speak. Two of his first 3 starts have been very rough. What are your thoughts on his early struggles?
You know, I think just a little off with his location right now, and that's going by what Tyler Flowers was saying after the game in Detroit on Sunday. And it's interesting because, you know, Cespedes took him deep twice, and one thing Quintana does not do is give up the home run much. So I think he'll get things right. You know, he's one of those guys who kind of flies under the radar, partially because the man has 40 no decisions since he became a starter, which leads the major leagues, but also because, you know, he doesn't have like Chris Sale's stuff or Jeff Samardzija's stuff. He's got good stuff, but all he does is put up good numbers, you know, 200 innings, 30 some starts, you know, ERA in the mid 3s, which is pretty darn good in the American League. And, you know, he's done that for a couple of years. If Quintana had only done it for like over a 20 start period in 1 year and then had this rough start, you know, it's only 3 starts, you'd say, okay, maybe it's time to keep an eye on, but I think he'll be fine. I think it's just, you know, much like hitters who start the year 6-for-30 or 6-for-40, when they have nothing to base it off of, it looks worse than it is right now at the start of the season.
And on that very note, Merck, Adam Eaton's struggles at the top of the order have kind of set the tone, I think, for the overall picture here. You know, like you said, if he goes in a rut like this, I think it's gone on long enough that it would be noticed if it was midseason, but obviously not, it wouldn't be quite as panic-inducing as it is at the start of the season, but just his troubles trying to get things going for the lineup. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, no question. I think he's 6-for-44. He was 6-for-44 as of the end of that road trip, you know, with the loss to Detroit. And Robin Ventura had a great comment after the game where he just said, you know, everything Eaton does is kind of high energy, high speed, and he's very tough on himself. And he almost needs him to take a step back and just kind of relax a little bit. And I think Eaton would tell you that he's, you know, he's fine. He enjoys playing the game and all that. And it's just a slump. And he went through a few of these last year. But I think the longer it goes, and, you know, it has nothing to do with the contract. He's not trying to live up to the contract. He did tell me earlier in the year in an off-day story I did, you know, back after the first game that, you know, he wants to be better than the contract. So I think a small part, you know, that plays on his mind. But I don't think that's driving him. I don't think he's going out there and saying, I'm 0-for-4 and I got this big contract in spring training. I just think he's in a slump. He's in a rut right now. And he'll get through it. You know, he's a good player. Again, it's not like he, you know, hasn't had success before. And, you know, Ventura's words are good ones, that he should probably just take a step back, kind of relax. I wouldn't be surprised this homestand that, you know, he gets a day off somewhere in there if the slump continues. Just kind of a mental health break, just to kind of sit back and get a different perspective of the game, maybe give J.B. Shuck and a start to go out there and give Eaton a little rest.
Well, I was I did a column last week talking to Robin Ventura about these early issues and his how his even keeled demeanor. I'm sure there's some segment of the fan base that would like to see him screaming at Adam Eaton in the dugout, you know, with these early struggles. That's just not Ventura's personality, and that's a thing. A slow start like this, you got to keep it all in perspective in a 162-game season.
Well, here's the thing that changes with the offseason that Rick Hahn put together is, you know, I was at Sox Fest when they had a lot of these new additions come in, and it was very much like a revival session. You know, I mean, it was probably just short of the celebration after they won the World Series. That's how excited fans were. But now the caveat to that is, if you have that excitement and you start off 4-7 and the Tigers and Royals don't start off 4-7 and start off in, you know, the 10-2, 9-2 range, well, then you get that same level of negative thought, you know, going in the reverse direction. So now it goes from, oh my God, we're going to win the World Series this year, we're going to at least be a playoff team, to what a disaster, we're 4-7, fire the manager, do this and do that. I mean, is Robin even perfect? I'm sure he'd be the first to say he hasn't been perfect. You know, in that game, the famous game Friday now, the most famous, what was it, game 9 of the season for the White Sox. You know, in the ninth inning when the call was kind of up in the air, he probably should have challenged it just because that was the winning run at second base and nobody on him. What did he have to lose at that point? But he did. It's done. And you move on from that. But it's very easy because of the fact that, you know, as the old saying goes, you're not going to fire 25 guys. So it's very easy just to point to the manager and say, you know, time for a change. He's not this enough. He's not that enough. If he was too boisterous, they'd probably say, you know, he doesn't have enough control of the team. He's always, you know, he's always out there. So you can't win on that. And Robin Ventura, I think, has the good sense and good viewpoint that he just focuses on what he has to do. He doesn't worry about kind of the outside noise and from us or from the fans or anything else. And everyone's entitled to their opinion. I get it. Fans are not happy with a 4-7 record. But you can't blame starting rotation, starting slowly, or the hitters hitting below their norm just on Robin Ventura. That makes no sense. These are professionals, and this is a veteran team. We're not talking about a team full of first and second-year players. These are guys who have done it and done it well many times. You know, look at Melky Cabrera playing in a World Series team. And they're going to come around, but, you know, it'll be interesting to see if they do come around and start winning, will Robin get the credit then? It's a thankless job. You know, unless you win it all, it's pretty much a thankless job.
That it is, Merck. That it is. That is the job of Scott Merck and himself. So I want to thank you. Joining us, as always, is Rhett Bollinger. Rhett, the Twins had a brutal start to the season and then turned things around pretty quickly with series wins against division opponents, the Royals and Indians. And, you know, obviously no one was panicking after the first week of play, but how much better is the vibe around that team the way things went the second week?
It's definitely better. I mean, obviously to start off 1-5 and to come home and play in the home opener and get beat 12-3 against the Royals and have a lot of miscues defensively, you know, Troy Hunter throwing the infield, you know, went by a couple guys and kept rolling and just kind of one of those bad news Bears games, as Troy Hunter said after the game. They had an off day the next day, and sure enough, right after that, they came back and handed the Royals their first loss of the season. And ever since then, now they've won, you know, 4 or 5 at home heading into Kansas City, which is something they really needed. Obviously, Kansas City was undefeated at the time. The Indians were, you know, kind of a trendy pick to win the division. So to get those kind of wins now definitely boosts their confidence. A lot of the guys are saying it kind of helped to have Mulder as a guy that's kind of even keel, didn't get too high or too low despite that slow start. Torrey Hunter was still in there kind of pumping guys up, letting them know, hey, you know, it's 1-5, that kind of thing happens throughout the season all the time. It just gets magnified when it happens at the start of the season. Right. I think it's, too, it's one of those things with the mentality. You know, it'd be one thing if a team just off to a slow start and they haven't had the last 4 years they've had, but it's tougher, I think, when they've, you know, been as bad as they've been for 4 years. I think the fan base is kind of growing weary and going, okay, here we go again. I think it was definitely important for them to kind of bounce back and do that over those last 5 games there at home.
Yeah, as everybody says, I mean, you don't win a division in April or anything like that, but obviously teams coming off of, you know, in the Twins' case, four, you know, really bad seasons, the start means something. It means something to people that you definitely want to have that positive momentum. It seemed like the offense just needed time to settle in. I mean, that's the number one thing that had to get clicking for them.
Yeah, definitely. The offense was kind of supposed to be the strong suit and came out pretty slow. I think if you still look at the overall numbers, the offense still really hasn't really got it done yet. But the last few days here, they started to kind of pick it up. Trevor Plouffe is going to be counted on as kind of a big bat in that offense, considering his kind of breakout year last year with 40 doubles as a third baseman. And his bat's starting to get going now. He had the game-winning home run against the Indians and then came right back and had a day off and came right back and had two doubles and a single off the wall. It would have been a double, so it would have been read correctly by the guy first. But, yeah, so it's one of those things where some of these guys, Mauer still is hitting for a little bit of average, but hasn't really got that slugging percentage going up at all. I think he only has just the one extra base hit. So I think some of these guys, Arcia, starting to come around a little bit. I think Santana right now is kind of one of the big issues. He's really been struggling, especially as a leadoff hitter, coming off a great rookie season, but so far hasn't really been able to back that up. I think everyone kind of knew he'd regress, you know, a little bit, considering no one ever saw him as a 319 hitter like he was last year. But I think this, you know, kind of slow starts kind of got them a little bit concerned. But the good news is they can kind of give him days off here and there with Eduardo Escobar as a capable backup. But, yeah, I think the offense can definitely get better than it's showing right now, but definitely to get better over those last 4 or 5 days there on the homestand.
You mentioned Plouffe, and before that walk-off home run against the Indians on Friday, he was 4-for-34, so it just goes to show you how quickly one swing of the bat can change everything for a guy. But, you know, his breakout season last year, you mentioned the 40 doubles, 14 home runs to go with that. What's the key for him sustaining that? Because for a lot of people, I mean, that kind of came out of nowhere. You know, no disrespect to Plouffe, but I mean, it was really a breakout season for him at more of a later stage in his late 20s. So what's the key for him sustaining that this season, Rhett?
Well, he's shown some flashes before. He had that one streak a couple years ago where I think in July he hit, you know, more than 10 home runs. I think he ended up with 24 homers that year. So he'd always shown at least some, you know, as a former first-round pick, he'd always show some potential. But it was just always that consistency, you know, as a guy that strikes out a decent amount, never really get that average up. And last year, finally kind of put it all together and didn't really get as many home runs as he's done in the past, with just you know, the 14 of them. But 40 doubles still showed that he's hitting the ball pretty hard, and obviously Target Field's a pretty big ballpark. So, yeah, I think they're just kind of getting consistent at bats. I think that he, you know, kind of having the third base job all to himself in the past, he'd always have kind of someone looking over his shoulder. Obviously right now he's got Miguel Sano doing just that again. But, yeah, so it's one of those things I think that he works really well with the hitting coach Tom Brunansky. He changed some things mechanically, too. If you look at his swing when he first came up to the big leagues to what it's like now, just mechanically it's different. His hands are in a different spot. You know, even his stride and the way he swings is just a little bit different. So I think that Brunansky, I think a lot of younger guys definitely kind of credit Brunansky for kind of working with them and kind of tweaking their mechanics a little bit. Dozier, too. I mean, Dozier's a guy that the power he's shown so far in the big leagues was, you know, not at all what the Twins expected from him. They kind of expected him to be a guy that could walk and get on base. And kind of just be a decent enough hitter up the middle, but for him to show that kind of power he's shown too, I think that, you know, his mechanics have changed a little bit too. So I think that that gives some credit to the hitting coach.
Yeah. Yeah, and to your point earlier there, I think Target Field is one of those places where, you know, guys who play their home games in a park like that, you almost have to look at extra base hit totals instead of just, you know, gravitating towards the home run total. He had 56 extra base hits last season. That's a very strong season. And as you said earlier, Rhett, Joe Mauer just with one extra base hit in the early action here, but I'm more intrigued by the beard. Joe Mauer with a beard just is such a strange sight to me.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. We talked about it at the home opener and asked him what was with it. We didn't know if it was for the Minnesota Wild, if it was a hockey playoff beard or not. But he said it was mostly just because he thought he'd just do something different, throw it out thinking that it was going to be a cold April. And sure enough, it was in the 70s all weekend in the first homestand of the year, which is you know, pretty unusual and pretty great, to be honest, in Minnesota. So we'll definitely take that. So, yeah, he said thought it was going to be cold, and I don't know, I'll keep it anyway, and his wife really liked it, so he stuck with it.
Well, I'm glad we cover all the big issues on this podcast, obviously, so I'm
exactly,
glad we
exactly.
Straightened that out. Another big issue, Trevor May gets a spot in the rotation on account of Ricky Nolasco's injury. Was really good on Sunday against the Indians. He had never gone sixth inning in the big leagues without allowing at least three runs. But against the Tribe, one run on four hits with no walks in six innings. And as you wrote, Rhett, the two-seamer was a big part of that, something he's breaking out this year on a more frequent basis and really tied up the Indians.
Yeah, absolutely. The two-seamer is something that kind of last year he teamed with a little bit but started using it more. Carlos Santana on the Indians said that it surprised them that the scouting report said that he threw it a little bit, but mostly inside the guys. And sure enough, he was sort of inside, outside, locating it well. And then he's always had a pretty good changeup. That's kind of always one of the big keys for the new pitching coach, Neil Allen. He loves changeups, so he's having him throw a lot of his changeups, and both to righties and lefties, inside, outside, and really was locating both his fastball and his changeup really well. And he can do that. He can be a pretty good pitcher. And then he threw in the fact that, you know, yesterday didn't really have it, but in general, he's got a pretty good breaking ball, and he's got a slider too. And the four-seamer has always kind of been his bread and butter because he throws so hard. So really, if you got that many pitches in your mix, you can kind of get some of those pitches working on given days. He can be a pretty good starter. And if you look back now, the ERA isn't pretty, but if you go back his last 50 innings or so, he's got about 49 strikeouts, 48 strikeouts, and only 10 walks. So really, if you look at it, the strikeout-to-walk ratio has been pretty good now, striking out about a batter per inning, which is some pretty good signs. I mean, he's got to cut down on giving up home runs and obviously did not give up any of the Indians the other day. But really, he's starting to show some signs of why he's such a top prospect and what he can do in that rotation. Like I said, the ERA still for his career isn't pretty, but even in the home opener when he gave up five runs and like five and a third, really that game was kind of the defense kind of let him down. There were a lot of defensive miscues and misplays. He really didn't pitch that poorly in that game and had good control. I think he might have walked one guy. So I think that was kind of the issue. When he first came up, as we know, his first start in the big leagues, obviously all those walks in the first inning, and in general, his first few starts was just kind of wild and all over the place. But ever since then, he's quietly kind of putting that issue behind him. He's starting to throw a lot more strikes. And so I think the Twins are definitely going to have an interesting decision to have once Ricky Nolasco is ready to come off the DL, whether they're going to keep May in that rotation or if they're going to see if they want to move Pelfrey back to the bullpen. It's definitely going to be interesting to watch over the next 2 weeks here.
It is, and obviously not a decision they have to make immediately. Nolasco, sounds like he's going out on rehab next weekend.
Yes, he'll be pitching for Class A Cedar Rapids on Saturday.
Okay. So, yeah, he's progressing on schedule then, basically. And, back to May, just the development of these young arms, May, Meyer, this is so important for this club. The Twins have shown how difficult it is to basically go out and buy a quality rotation in free agency. They've spent a lot of money and haven't always gotten strong returns from the last goal last year. And, obviously, you saw what happened to Irvin Santana suspension this year.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as you said, that's $100 billion in contracts to both those guys, Nolasco and Santana. And so far, we saw Nolasco post an ERA above 5 last year, Santana's 80-game suspension. But yeah, guys like May, guy that's going to be cost-controlled, if it could happen in the next 6 years, will be huge for them. And obviously got him in that big trade for Ben Revere and Vance Worley as well, but obviously Worley didn't really work out as much in Minnesota, and he's done a pretty good job since he left with the Pirates. And Meyer so far, the big issue for him, I don't know if this is mechanics or confidence. Terry Ryan said he thinks it's more of confidence than mechanics, but so far he's walking a ton of guys, walking more than a batter per inning. A Triple-A is kind of a carryover from his spring training struggles. So he's kind of got to get it back on the right track before he kind of makes his debut up here at some point. And another kind of wild card guy, Jose Berrios at Double-A, has just been dominating. He's only 20 years old. He had a great spring. He remains one of the top prospects in the organization, but he doesn't get as much pub, I don't think, as guys like Meyer and May, the big hard-throwing 6'5" and 6'9" guy, whereas Berrios is probably 6 feet tall, top, maybe 5'11", but throws real hard. So far, his track record at the minors has been great. He goes after guys. I think he's another guy that you could probably definitely see making his major debut at some point this season, too.
Yeah, not a guy they want to rush, obviously, but, you know, he kind of asserts himself statistically. It's hard not to get excited about him. And you know, we've seen how needs quickly can present themselves, as was the case for the Twins the first couple of weeks. But we'll continue to watch Mr. May as he develops the big league level and as the Twins try to build off of a strong second week. I want to thank Rhett Bollinger for joining us, and thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Minnesota Twins edition.